Good afternoon. My name is Alan Kratz, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Mustafa Ujamaa. My attorney registration number is 27367. I will certainly attempt to answer any questions this court may have regarding any of the issues presented in the opening brief, all of which I believe are meritorious, but due to the time constraints, I would like today to focus on the first issue presented therein, and that, of course, concerns whether reversal is required due to the prosecution's admission and use of Mr. Ujamaa's post-arrest silence to argue in front of the jury that it could draw an unfavorable inference as to the credibility of his direct trial his direct examination testimony based upon his exercise of his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. Well, since 1976, when Doyle versus Ohio was decided by the United States Supreme Court, it has been settled law that the prosecution's impeachment use of a suspect's post-Miranda silence violates due process of law for two reasons, basically. First, such silence in the wake of the advisement itself is insolubly ambiguous. Since the suspect is advised of his Miranda rights and told that he has a right to remain silent, and that anything, if he gives up that right, anything he says can and will be used against him in a court of law, the fact that he exercises the right may simply reflect that he is choosing to stand upon his constitutional rights. Secondly, the Miranda advisement itself, according to Doyle, carries the implicit assurance that silence will carry no penalty. So where a person remains silent after receiving an advisement of his Fifth Amendment rights, including that he may remain silent and that if he waives his right to remain silent, anything he says will be used against him, the prosecution is prohibited from calling attention to such silence and insisting that because the defendant did not speak about the facts of the case at the time, as he was told he need not do, an unfavorable inference might be drawn as to the truth of his trial testimony.
Counsel, given that your client relied upon the Make My Day statute as one of his defenses, why wasn't the fact that he wasn't immediately invoking that statutory provision, why wasn't that fair game for the prosecution to use it to rebut your defense as opposed to using his silence as an inference of guilt?
Well, it's clear, Your Honor, that from the record that the prosecution used defendant's post-arrest silence to make the argument that if he had acted in self-defense or according to the Make My Day statute, as he testified to on direct examination, that he would have set forth that defense after he was advised of his Miranda rights.
Oh, what are you saying, counsel? First of all, was there an objection made to the use of this evidence?
It is a plain error.
Okay.
Issue, Your Honor.
And second thing is, wasn't there testimony by your client that he had gone to the police station to talk to the police, to cooperate with the police? If nothing else was said, wouldn't the jury have inferred that he had talked to the police and had cooperated with the police?
I don't believe that's quite accurate, Your Honor. He testified that right after the incident, he intended to turn himself into the police and tell the police what happened. He then later testified, still on direct examination, that before he actually went to the police station, he decided he better contact a lawyer. So he talked to counsel. He testified that he then turned himself in at the police station. And he was asked on direct examination whether he had told the police about the location of Kaufman's body. And he testified that he did not, because his lawyers told him not to. So he testified that initially he intended to tell the police what happened. But of course, as discussed in cases like Quintana, once a person is arrived at the police station and is given their Miranda rights, the whole calculus changes, because at that point they first understand, of course, that whatever they say can be used against him, and also they're now in a hostile, coercive atmosphere.
So wasn't there a second question asked, whether by defense counsel or earlier on cross-examination of your client, saying, so you went to the police station to cooperate, and he said yes?
I believe that he testified that his initial intent was to go to the police station to cooperate.
So once he...
That he changed his intent before he arrived at the police station, after he consulted with his attorneys.
So once he opens the door to that line of questioning by saying, I intended to cooperate, why isn't it fair game for the prosecution to delve into, but you didn't in fact cooperate, you never gave your side of the story?
Well, again, I believe that the record indicates that he testified he intended to cooperate initially, but that subsequently, after he was told by his lawyers not to impart a certain piece of information, and after he was advised of his Miranda rights, he conceded that at that point, it was suggested that he didn't cooperate at that point. But that certainly didn't open the door to the prosecution's use of any silence to suggest that that because he was silent after being given the Miranda advisement, that the jury could infer his trial testimony was a fabrication. And the reason is that the rationale given in Doyle versus Ohio for prohibiting the use of the evidence in this manner still applied here. That once you arrive at the police station, as I said before, you are advised of your Miranda rights, you are told that anything you say can and will be used against you, and as discussed in Quintana, Colorado Supreme Court case, there are a number of reasons at that point why an innocent person would stand on his constitutional right to remain silent. Not only the fact that he's told anything he says can and will be used against him, but now he's in this intimidating coercive atmosphere, and he may very well believe that my initial intent may not be such a good idea here. The police, telling my story may not be the best in my best interests, even though I want to.
I thought originally he didn't want to tell a story because he thought the police might kill him, but that after reflection, he decided he would go to the police station and talk to them.
That, I don't believe that quite what he said, Your Honor. He testified that he initially didn't want to call the police because of his fear that when they came to the place, to the residence,
it's true,
they would kill him. And then he testified, therefore, that there is evidence, however, that he did try to summon the police before he left the residence. And at that point, he decided that his best option was to drive to the police station.
Counsel, did you cite any cases in your brief indicating under analogous circumstances it would have been plain error warning reversal?
I believe that the most analogous, the case that's on point in Colorado is Ortega. That's a 1979 case. I believe I cited it in my brief. I'm not positive. I believe I did. And that's a case where the Supreme Court ruled that the error in this context is so egregious that it amounts to plain error.
The underlying principles, some might say the underlying principles of Ortega may have shifted a bit since then.
Ortega certainly didn't go into a detailed plain error analysis, but I think that even if you do, in this case, you would find plain error. First of all, the error was obvious. As I said before, the case law was settled in this area. Doyle versus Ohio came out in 1976. Secondly, the trial judge was well aware that we were talking about post-impeachment silence here. Indeed, it was the prosecution on cross-examination that admitted the exhibits showing that Mr. Ujamaa was given a written advisement of his Miranda rights, and then he chose to exercise his right to remain silent at that point. So I clearly believe there is a reasonable possibility that the error here contributed to the convictions. There was certainly not overwhelming evidence of guilt. The prosecution's evidence depended on a lot of speculative evidence about the contents of certain text messages, but those contents were never revealed. We don't know what they said. Mr. Ujamaa testified on direct examination that he did not have his wife's cell phone at the time these text messages were sent. So credibility was obviously a critical issue, in particular Mr. Ujamaa's credibility. And this error, this erroneous admission of his exercise of his right to remain silent, and the prosecution's repeated use of that evidence to argue that the jury could infer from his failure to tell his story at the time he was arrested at the police station that he's guilty, that clearly undermined his credibility unfairly, according to Doyle versus Ohio. But if there's no further questions, I think I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief of Court. Ajit Diaz, registration 36043, representing the people in this case. I will also focus on the first issue. As counsel has argued, it is clear, first of all, because there was a reference to the lack of evidence or not overwhelming evidence, I'd like to emphasize this point, as I have done in the answer brief, because this point has not been adequately addressed in the briefs by defendant and also at trial. The fact that there was overwhelming evidence that Mr. Ojama had his wife's cell phone with him, and the evidence conclusively establishes that based on the phone call that he made to Seattle in dealing with the seller of a car on Craigslist. That phone call made in the morning of the day at issue conclusively establishes that Mr. Ojama had his wife's cell phone with him.
Let me ask you about conclusively establishes. It looks like that's pretty strong evidence, but conclusively establishes, did the prosecution bring in the fellow from Seattle to say, yes, I talked with a man that day? Did the prosecution bring in the recipient of that phone call to say, I talked with a man that day?
I believe, Your Honor, the person in Seattle testified. However, on that day, the phone call went through but was disconnected before there was any conversation held, because apparently the defendant realized at that point that he was making a big mistake. So he immediately ended the call, but the record shows that the call was made. And that is conclusive evidence that he had the phone.
And was there also evidence about the location of the phone when the call was initiated? Is that what GPS?
There was evidence of the tower location where the message was conveyed, yes, sir.
And was that near his ex-wife's home?
Exactly. So as far as the overwhelming evidence is concerned, and I like again to emphasize that there was no explanation offered at trial or even on appeal to justify that call and explain it away as not conclusively established. As far as the legal question is concerned, case law is clear. I have cited the cases in the answer brief. Chavez is perhaps the most relevant analogous case where the defendant was, the issue in there was defendant's refusal to consent to a search, and the court concluded that admitting that evidence was proper based on the testimony that was given, that the evidence of refusal impeached him and his testimony. And that's one difference between this case, Chavez, and the defendant's case, and Ortega, because in Ortega, the defendant had not testified. Here, what we have, again, as set out clearly in the answer brief, pages 11 through 13, from the very beginning of the trial, defense counsel's argument was that defendant was cooperative. He had nothing to hide. He was going to the police to explain from the opening statement to the testimony of the defendant himself. And I certainly disagree with counsel that during direct examination, defendant gave any idea about his decision not to cooperate. All the information that came out making him acknowledge that he had actually changed his mind and had not disclosed, that he had decided not to disclose the circumstances of the killing, all of that information came out through cross-examination. So if he had not been impeached, the jury would have certainly been left with the impression that he had nothing to hide, he went to the police and gave all the information. Based on the testimony and the argument made by counsel, it was proper under Chavez and other cases that I cite, including Davis, although some of them deal with pre-Miranda situation, but Chavez deals with post-Miranda as well. So there is no distinction in that respect. What makes it appropriate here is that it was to rebut the claim both expressly made and also by suggesting, based on the arguments made by the counsel, that defendant had voluntarily gone to the police and provided all the information that was needed. So it was proper for the prosecution to use that information to cross-examine defendant on that basis and also use that information during closing argument, which is another claim made that this constituted some prosecutorial misconduct because it was improper. But because the evidence was appropriate, it was rebuttal evidence to establish that the defendant, contrary to the impression left by defense counsel and himself during direct examination, had not voluntarily gone to the police to provide all the information regarding the circumstances of the killing. The prosecutor's comment was appropriate, and the evidence was also admitted properly. There was no plain error. Unless the court has any questions, we stand by the position stated in the brief on the other issues, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. If not, we ask the court to affirm defendant's conviction on all counts.
I'd like to respond briefly to the state's argument that there was overwhelming evidence of guilt here, and specifically with respect to the phone calls that were made from the wife's phone. What the opposing counsel neglects to mention is that there was also evidence that the times given for many of these calls was by no means reliable. There is evidence, for example, that one call that had been placed at a certain time, it was not reflected in the evidence that it had been made at that time. That in fact, it was made hours, or even it can even be made days earlier. In fact, there was expert testimony to that effect. That occasionally a call, for some reason, won't go through for hours or days. And so, you know, at best, this evidence concerning the phone calls and text messages was speculative. The expert conceded that just because a phone call came from a certain cell phone tower, that wasn't terribly reliable evidence as to where that cell phone was at the time. That because of the complexities of it, sometimes the data will reflect that the call came from a tower far away from where the call was actually initiated.
Mr. Kratz, as I understand it, though, it was pretty much undisputed that Mr. Ujana killed the victim. And so the question in terms of whether there was overwhelming defense or not turns on the make my day defense. Is that not correct?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, that yes, Mr. Ujana testified. He conceded that he killed the victim, killed Mr. Kaufman. He testified that at that time he believed that Kaufman was a stranger who had simply trespassed into the house. There was evidence not only from Mr. Ujamo's testimony, but also medical evidence that Kaufman was apparently raising his arm at the time that Mr. Ujamo fired his weapon. So there was evidence indicating some sort of aggressive type of conduct on the part of Kaufman. And of course, Mr. Ujamo testified that at that time, he had no idea who this was. As far as he knew, it was an intruder who had entered the house without knocking, just uninvited, and was now moving toward him. Now, I acknowledge that there is evidence that Mr. Ujamo testified he initially intended to tell the police what happened. But I completely dispute the allegation that he gave any testimony indicating he cooperated with the police at the police station and that he told his story there. That, of course, is the Davis-type situation where the defendant testified on direct examination that he told the police what happened. And, of course, when that happens, the prosecution may introduce evidence of a defendant's post-arrest silence in order to rebut that specific theory.
What happens if the testimony amounts to, the suggestion that, I went there to cooperate, nothing else said whether I did or didn't cooperate? What happens if the record is like that? Does that open the door to it?
Well, I dispute that premise of that, in that
I understand you dispute the premise.
He testified that once he got to the police station, he didn't cooperate. He made that clear. He was asked, did you tell the police the location of the body? He said, no, I didn't. My lawyers told me not to.
It's a little different, though, isn't it, from saying, did you tell the police the circumstances under which the individual was killed?
That's true. But it may, if it suggests anything, Your Honor, I think it suggests that he didn't cooperate with the police, that he was silent. And of course, even assuming that opens the door to the prosecution then introducing evidence that he exercised his constitutional right to remain silent, it clearly does not open the door to what the prosecution did here, which was use that evidence to argue that the jury could draw this unfavorable inference that's prohibited by Doyle versus Ohio. And of course, the reason is that the rationale still applies here. He may have invoked his right to remain silent because he was advised of that right, because now he knows that I'm in a hostile, intimidating atmosphere. My lawyers have told me at least not to answer one question posed by the police. So even though I intended to cooperate initially, I intended to tell my story initially, now, after realizing I have a constitutional right to remain silent, it's in my best interest not to do that at this time. So the point, of course, is that it's not, under these facts, it certainly was not admissible as rebuttal evidence, and the door was not open to admission of that evidence. So I would just request that this court reverse the judgment of conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.